I also think that when you haven't been practicing for a while, you don't assume that you know things, and you can be diligent about learning things. You know, most of the answers are there in the rules and in the case law and in the code. And if you know you have to go there to look for them because you don't assume that you know them, then I view that as an advantage. And many of my cases in my first couple of years, I can recall instances where because I read the rules and someone else on the other side assumed that they knew something that wasn't exactly what was in the rules, it worked out to my client's advantage.
Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 20 of The Law Entrepreneur with my guest today, Evan Goitein. Evan is a solo practitioner here in Montgomery County who has been in practice as a solo since 2010. Before that, he worked on Capitol Hill, and his practice primarily focuses on family law, construction law in the civil litigation arena, as well as foreclosure defense. Each of those areas represents about a third of his workload. He's located in Bethesda, Maryland. He is a cum laude graduate of the University of Massachusetts undergrad and went to George Washington University Law School here in Washington, D.C. for his law degree. Evan also is the co-chair of the solo and small firm section of the Bar Association of Montgomery County. And we're going to hear him chat a little bit about the role of bar associations in the education of solo attorneys, the lack of business education being offered by the law schools, and his approach to networking and marketing his firm as a solo practitioner. So without any further delay, let's listen to Evan Goitein. Hey there, Evan. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be with me today. Evan, tell our audience a little bit about your practice and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, I have a practice that is based out of Bethesda, here in the what used to be known as the Air Rights Building in the center of Bethesda. And I practice primarily in Montgomery County, although I do get to different areas of the state, I would say, other than Montgomery County. Prince George's County and Anne Arundel County is where I spend most of my time. And it's a litigation-based practice. I would generally describe it as being divided into three portions that are on the whole equal, although I certainly at they tend to have, over a period of time, sometimes I'm doing more of certain things and less, but I do domestic, and I'd say that's about a third. I do general civil litigation, contract disputes. In that realm, there's a lot of construction-related matters, real estate-related matters that tend to make up the largest percentage of that third of my practice. And then I also do foreclosure defense and assist people who are in default in their mortgage. I would say by client volume, that is the biggest part of my practice. However, one foreclosure case doesn't require nearly as many man hours as, let's say, a divorce would. So by the amount of time I spend working on things, it still falls into approximately a third of what I do.
And how long have you been a solo, Evan?
It will be 6 years next week.
Excellent. And did you come straight out of law school to your solo practice, or did you transition from another firm?
Yeah, I started my firm right out of law school, and it was really a matter of necessity. You know, I did okay for myself. I had I worked in Congress for 5 years, And then while I was there, I started going to law school. I went to George Washington University. I did well there. All of that is to say that I think I was a fairly attractive candidate for employment coming out of law school. And that was certainly my desire. But in 2009, I found myself in a situation where most law firms were downsizing rather than hiring. And so, you know, it wasn't exactly what I had envisioned when I committed myself to law school 3 years earlier. And I was sort of stuck and forced into it. At that point, I sort of viewed myself having a law license as any other person with a vocational license and thought that, you know, I could just get to work. I did also, during my last semester of law school, work as a law clerk for another solo practitioner. So, you know, after being there a couple months, I was doing a lot of the work, and I felt like, other than signing the pleadings, I had performed a lot of the tasks that would be needed working on my own. So I did have that sort of introduction to it. The only thing that was missing from that was actually being in court. And then I dove into that pretty quickly.
The firm that you clerked for, what was their practice area?
It was mainly domestic and employment.
Okay. So you got a feel for the civil side of things, the litigation side of things, your last semester in law school.
Yes.
Well, you kind of, you know, unfortunately, like a lot of people picked the wrong year to graduate from law school, 2009, with the downturn in the economy, as you said, and the impact that it had on all the major law firms around the area, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area. It made for a very tough job market. When did you, in law school, when did you kind of come to the realization that a solo practice was where you were going to have to head?
Not at all during law school. And in fact, since I've graduated, I have tried with varying degrees of success to go back to George Washington, where I went to law school, and then also try to reach out to other schools to suggest that that maybe be part of the law school curriculum. And at least I think more people are aware of it these days because, you know, when I was in law school, at least when I started law school, there was the assumption that you're going to pay your dues, do your work, and then you're going to get hired. And so the idea of having to start your own practice, start your own business, it's not something that anyone ever introduced to me in law school. And, you know, I mean, you said, unfortunately, I picked the wrong time to graduate, but I wouldn't, at this point, looking back, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Right.
I'm very glad that I was forced into this situation because I'm very happy with everything now. And, you know, if I had just been hired somewhere, I might still be working there and I might not know the great opportunities that exist as a solo practitioner. So part of what I would like to do, and I'll admit to not being as involved as I should be in the last couple of years, is to introduce to students in law school this idea that this is something that you can consider doing right out of law school. I have spoken at GW a couple of times on panels about this, and I bring up a few points that I view as strengths for people coming right out of law school in terms of going into solo practice, as opposed to, you know, I think a lot of people just think that they're inexperienced and they don't know sort of the rules of the road, and they have to learn those before they can go out on their own. And there's something to that, but I also think there are other areas where it's a strength. For example, the rules of evidence. You know, when you take the rules of evidence in your second year or third year of law school, and then you have to just have a boot camp session on them for the bar exam, I view it as learning a language, right? If you, you know, you take French for 4 years of high school, well, if you go to France the next year, you're probably going to hone your skills and continue to improve upon those skills that you've developed well, as opposed to if you take 2 or 3 years off and only speak the language once a month, and then all of a sudden you have to jump right back into it. So I think it's a way to stay fresh and a way to remember some of the rules that sometimes seasoned practitioners overlook. And I also think that when you haven't been practicing for a while, you don't assume that you know things, and you can be diligent about learning things. You know, most of the answers are there in the rules and in the case law and in the code. And if you know you have to go there to look for them because you don't assume that you know them, then I view that as an advantage. And many of my cases in my first couple of years, I can recall instances where because I read the rules and someone else on the other side assumed that they knew something that wasn't exactly what was in the rules, it worked out to my client's advantage. So, yeah. And then the other thing is that when you're starting right out of law school, you can't say, you know, right now I've described a little bit of my practice, and you know, I can generally say that I'm sort of finding the areas of law that I'm going to be working with now. But when you start off law school, you don't have anything like that. You have nothing that you're tied to. So if a case comes along and you think you're interested and you can, with the right support, take that case on and it's something that you really want to do, then you really have a great sense of, or a wide breadth of opportunity to take on different practice areas. And that's what happened with me with the whole foreclosure defense thing. I mean, Maryland changed its foreclosure laws in 2010. And I saw that as, well, look, here's an area where nobody has a lot of experience because we have a brand new rules, brand new law on the foreclosure process. And right now, not knowing it at all, well, I know it just about as well as anyone else. So if I put in the time to learn about it, then that's going to be an area where I can succeed, and it has been.
Yeah, and it was a great need at the time as well.
It was, so, and surprisingly, it still is.
Yeah. You know, Evan, you touched on a point that actually is the reason for this podcast. I share your opinion that, and your experience, that the law schools today don't prepare the students for the possibility, or in some cases, the probability that they're going to have to start a solo practice straight out of law school. And so that's one of the reasons we started the podcast here, to try and provide some of that feedback, some of that information. And so I appreciate that you have that same concern. The other thing is, you know, as you mentioned, as a solo practitioner, you have a lot of flexibility. You can pivot as the need arises. So let's talk about how you transitioned through those twists and turns. So you're applying for jobs like everybody else in your second, third year, and graduation day comes up, and if you're like me, you were still looking. So what happened after that?
Well, it's tough to recall, actually. I started going to law school at night, and because I was working full time on the Hill during the day, and that was a 4-year program. And then the member of Congress I was working for retired, I think, toward the end of my second year. And so rather than go work for another member of Congress for the limited amount of time I had left until I graduated law school, I decided that I would sort of double up on my class work. And that meant that I finished sort of after the fall semester of my fourth year, so 3.5 years.
Sure.
And so it was a little bit different in that I was kind of graduating on my own as opposed to with my entire class in the summer. And so, I mean, I have a folder right now in my desk with 120 or so letters saying, thank you very much, you're an excellent candidate, but we don't think we have a place for you. So I certainly was.
I have that same folder.
I won't tell you what the title of the folder is, so I certainly was trying, and I was applying. I also, my daughter was born, I think, 2 months before I graduated from law school, so I was—
So no pressure.
Yeah, there was the pressure, but there was also sort of the sense of I had something else going on, and, I had my wife telling me, you're gonna wish at some point that you're lucky that you're able to spend these first few months of her life and be with her so much. And I was.
Yeah.
And so there was that as well. I did eventually find a couple of opportunities doing regulatory work. I mean, I think because of my background on the Hill, I was more interesting to some of the federal government agencies.
But when did you start as a solo? When did you open your practice?
June 17th, 2010 was the day I got sworn in. And then I came back to my office and, to the extent you can open up shop, that's when I did. So,
So you already had space at that point?
Yeah. What had happened was the person who I was working for, it was the same suite, and there was sort of a, I won't call it a closet, but I think some other people did. Right. And I thought, well, if I set up shop here, that's going to be good because I'll be close to him and I'll get some overflow work. And, you know, the suite that I'm in, it's sort of like a co-op. There are a bunch of solo and small firms here. And that's great for referrals.
Sure.
And so I sort of just stumbled into a really great situation where there's not only referrals around, but there's also support. You know, right. We oftentimes will go knock on each other's doors and talk about our cases and get that kind of feedback. That's, I think, one of the things that solos can miss out on if they don't have those other people around, is just the ability to talk to another lawyer about a case and run something up the flagpole and, you know, make sure that the ideas and the strategies that we're planning on taking are sound good to someone else.
All right. So you come back to the office and now your shingle's officially hung. And how'd you go about getting your first clients?
I went to the Bar Foundation. There's actually a program in the state of Maryland. I think it's called the Judicare program statewide. And then it's administered by each county's bar association. And what they do is they pay you a reduced fee to represent people in domestic matters where there are children involved. So custody, child support. And the deal is you get, you do one case completely pro bono for free. And then another case, you get paid a reduced fee. And I think I took 8 of those cases right out of the gate. And it was great. It gave me real hands-on experience, trial by fire. And the other thing, and I didn't realize this at the time, is that when you have a client who isn't paying your fees, they are, when you're getting close to trial and talking settlement, there's that element of it that they don't have to deal with. You know, sometimes the cost of a trial is something that weighs heavily on people and is certainly a deterrent to going to trial. Well, you take that out of the mix and people are much more willing to roll the dice. And for me, that was good because I got a lot of trial experience. I think I had 9 multi-day circuit court trials in my first year. And I was also...
It certainly is trial by fire. I mean, I did the same thing, the same program. And while I think all of that is true, there's also a flip side of that as well. And sometimes it can lead to an unreasonable expectation on the part of the client if they're not, you know, ponying up a fee. So it works a little bit of both ways on occasion.
I agree.
So you started off with the family law. What did you find that there were challenges that you had to overcome in terms of understanding the procedural aspects of starting down that path?
Well, I think another thing that's good when you're starting off as a solo and certainly when you're starting off out of law school is that there's no hiding that, you know, I guess at the time I was 28 or 29 years old. I mean, there's no hiding that you're younger than most other people around in the courtroom and you can't really pretend to have 30 years of experience when you're 28 years old. So I use that as a way to be upfront with the lawyers and the judges who I was involved with. And after a case was over, I would call up the judge's law clerk and say, you know, this was my second, third, fourth trial. And I'd really appreciate it if Judge so-and-so would spend 15 minutes with me just to talk about the way he or she felt about the way I handled the case. And I think without exception, the judges who I followed up with were more than generous with their time in giving me feedback.
You know, I think, Evan, I think that's a brilliant tactic. And it's one I don't believe many attorneys follow because this has been my experience. I mean, attorneys always, you know, moan and groan about judges in their case, but it's been my experience that overwhelmingly, particularly here in our county, and I'm fairly certain that's true in most others, that with a little bit of professionalism, you can solicit a lot of feedback, and the court is more than willing to assist you in that regard because it makes their life easier in the long run too.
Right, and then the same thing with lawyers on the other side. I mean, this wasn't always the case, but generally, if I had a good working relationship with the lawyer who I was trying the case against, you know, after the case was over, I'd call him or her up and say, you know, let's talk about it. And that's a little harder to do than with the judges because when you're finishing the case, you know, usually you've either won or lost.
Right.
So you don't want to call up after you've had a successful outcome and say, well, this was only my third trial, and you know, right, even though we prevailed, can you tell me what you think I could have done even better?
Yeah.
But so it was actually easier to do in the opposite case. But
yeah. Well, you know, I will tell you that some of my best friends in the legal community are attorneys that I lost cases to.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I think that probably says more about your character than maybe anything else.
So, how did you then also get into construction law?
Well, the firm that I sublease space from, sort of the prime tenant in our suite, they do transactional work, business planning, estate planning, but they don't do litigation. And so with them, and this is another overall strategy which I employed, you know, you get a lot of people who, let's say they pay $20,000 to have a new deck put on their house. And they get to the end and there's just a little bit of a dispute about some element of the project, but it's not necessarily something that's economically efficient when it comes to litigating. I mean, we had a lot of projects that were, let's say, less than $30,000, where most people knew that if they were fighting over that minimal amount, it wasn't going to make sense for them to take it to court. So I advertised myself as a resource in those situations to the other lawyers here who I was working with, and said, you know, I can handle these cases. And I would. I mean, I'd find a way to figure out an outcome that worked well for everyone involved. You know, I never want to have someone pay $12,000 to recover $10,000. And so I was upfront with the clients and saying, you know, look, we're not going to try this case, but here's what I think we can do to sort of negotiate a successful outcome. And we did. And so that was sort of the introduction into it. And then just by chance, I had a couple contractors who came to me. You know, I think actually it was contractors where I had represented the homeowner, and I had handled it sort of in a way that was not very adversarial, but just more of a, you know, look, there's this problem. Let's see how we can come to an agreement about it. They then came to me from the other side when they had an issue with, and from the contractor side, it's mainly collections.
Right.
You know, someone's not paying. And so I did a couple of mechanics liens cases like that. And then that was a role that I tried to find in this office suite that I'm in, was being able to help people with those types of problems that come up fairly often. And a lot of times people just think, well, you know, this isn't worth hiring a lawyer. And sometimes it's not, but at least I let them know that there was that opportunity to have a minimal financial commitment to try to not just walk away from a job that they might not consider to be done very well. And then from there, like everything else, you know, it got more involved to where I had cases involving, you know, I had one where it involved the reconstruction of an entire house.
Right.
And so it's gone from there. It's an interesting area of law for me. So, and it's also something, you know, I like to try cases. And so a lot of these construction cases you can try in the district court, and it's not overly expensive for the clients. And so they're certainly cases that I look for.
Yeah. You know, it's very similar in some ways, I think, to a gentleman we had on a couple of weeks ago, Sean Morris, who we advertise as the restaurant lawyer. So he was doing civil litigation and kind of focused in on the legal needs of the restaurant industry as the vertical within which he wanted to apply his civil practice. And I think that sounds very much like what you're doing here in terms of construction, primarily residential construction, applying the civil litigation skills to the needs of those in that industry.
Yeah, it's, you know, I try to, I guess at this point when people ask me about my practice, it's sort of evolved, and this is kind of what I want it to be, into an everyday problem type practice. You know, people have problems paying their mortgage, they have problems with money they've lent to someone, problems with a contractor on work they're trying to do with their home. You know, those are the areas where, you know, I when I first came to Washington to work on the Hill, it was with the idea that, well, you know, if I have to work for a living, I'd like to at least be able to do something that in some way is helping other people.
Yeah.
I have certainly found that as in the private practice of law, I have had more satisfying situations where I felt like I've been able to help someone with a situation they were dealing with than when I worked on the Hill. And, you know, that's not a comment, political comment, but
right.
That's just sort of how it's turned out for me, and being able to make my practice be something that ideally can help people deal with the problems that they're facing.
Well, it's a lifestyle issue. And certainly this seems to be resonating with you. It sounds to me like, you know, the tagline is you're a law firm that helps regular folks with their regular everyday legal problems.
That's the goal.
Yeah. So are you still located in the same physical space?
I will never leave this office, no matter what happens. I will always stay right here. It's not only just about exactly halfway between my house and the courthouse in Rockville, but the people in the suite who I work with have been so great to work with, and you know, they trusted me early on when I was inexperienced and young. They gave me some good cases, and I appreciate that. And so I'm going to continue to stay here to be a resource for them, which, of course, translates into good things for me.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I'll always be here.
How about your staffing? Are you still a one-man shop, or have you added staff?
Yeah, I first hired an associate I think after my second year, I hired someone just because I was getting too busy. And I sort of felt like at that point, I felt like the ultimate goal was to build a firm of, you know, half a dozen lawyers or so.
Sure.
And so I felt like it was the time to start adding. The woman who was working for me decided to move to California, and she left after about a year. And I went a while where I didn't replace her and I didn't have anyone else. And, you know, that was just a decision I basically made to work more. And that's one of the great things about being a solo practitioner, as you know, is, you know, if you want to make more money, you can work more. And then that's the option that was available. And so I did that. But then a few things happened around here where I started to just really get overloaded with more and more new clients, and it became necessary to hire another lawyer. So I did, and I have one other attorney who works for me now. I actually hired someone from one of the foreclosure firms that I regularly had cases against, so he could help me. You know, he knew that practice area very well, and he could help me with a lot of those cases. And then recently, I've also added an admin person. Just, you know, I mean, I guess I finally bought into the idea that if you're spending so much time doing administrative work and you can pay someone less than your hourly rate to do that, then it makes sense to go ahead and hire someone.
Sure.
And so that's what I've done.
So you have two associates plus an admin now?
Well, no, I have one associate plus an admin, and I actually share the admin. Again, that's a nice feature of being here, is that she basically works for my firm and another firm, because I don't think either one of us really have the need for a full-time admin person, but we're able to sort of split her.
And just for other attorneys who are considering adding staff, talk a little bit about the process. I mean, are you using a payroll firm like Paychecks to run Paychecks, or are you doing a fee splitting arrangement, or how mechanically or logistically did you bring these staff members aboard?
Well, from the hiring standpoint, you know, I had an idea that I needed to hire someone, and so I basically was keeping my eye open for about 6 months. And when I had cases against other lawyers, I would have that in the back of my mind, and I would ask around. And so that was the selection process, as opposed to just interviewing people. You know, I mean, I think around here, you could literally have thousands of people who could have a good resume and conduct a good half-hour interview. So I was fortunate enough to be in court often with other lawyers, and you know, I got a sense from some of them that they may be. I mean, I feel like my practice is a great thing to advertise as far as, you know, to another attorney, because there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how much you can work and how much money you can make. And so, you know, I was able to offer that, and I felt like it would be attractive to someone else. And I think it was. And so I basically just selected someone who I thought was in a good point at his career, and then also had displayed the competence and work ethic that in court, in real life situations that I wanted. And then from the logistics standpoint of hiring someone, yeah, I use a payroll company. I had in the past tried to do it myself, and I just found that I was spending so much time and paying so much in fees and penalties for doing it wrong that it's certainly outweighed the cost of whatever I paid to the payroll service.
So you bring on the associate and you pay them a salary?
Yeah, I mean, I pay him a base salary with a world of opportunity to exceed that.
Yeah. That, and when I was hired initially as an associate, that's exactly what the firm that hired me did. They was on a, you know, fairly low salary, which I understood at that point. But then there was an opportunity to supplement that based on results.
Right. Yeah. And that's the way I will always do it, because, you know, I want someone to have some skin in the game. And yeah. So, you know, like I can remember times where a call would come in here at 3 o'clock on a Friday, and you know, it would go down the hall. You know, anybody want this? If something about a real estate settlement that was going to happen over the weekend, and they needed someone to be involved and put out a last minute fire, and you know, it was going to basically require just taking your day up on Saturday, and no one else really wanted to do it, but you know, because of my business model, such a high percentage of the fees that my firm generates end up going, you know, being profit, that I looked at it as, well, you know, I can do this work and make this money. And you don't want it to be, or I don't want it to be the case where if I'm asking an associate to take on something like that over the weekend or do some extra work, where it's not going to, there's not going to be any additional benefit to them. And so I think I've created a situation where they feel like the more work they do, the more money they make, and that should work out well for everybody in the long run.
So it's a nice mix. I know some people in the family law area who have associate attorneys will pay their associate a small salary, and then they pay them a percentage of the hourly billing. And so they're essentially paying their way as they go. That's one model that works for some.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think my model has a combination of that. I reached out to a lot of different law firms, bigger and smaller, to try to get a sense as to what their compensation systems were. And you're right. There's really there's a wide variety out there of the way people do it. So I just sort of figured out what I thought would work best for me and work out best for him. And it certainly has worked out well to this point. You know, I'm glad that I brought someone else on. I was definitely losing a lot of business by spending so much time working on the cases that I had. I was not returning phone calls to potential clients. Right. I was turning stuff away. And, you know, I'm still in the early stages of my practice. And when you're there, you don't want to ever be doing that, because every case, big or small, has the potential to just spread into many other cases and referrals. Sure. And so it's just not a good idea to be the lawyer who can't call people back. So I've tried to do what I can to avoid falling into that pitfall again.
So tell us now, what are you doing now to attract clients to your firm?
I'm actually doing a lot less. And
less is sometimes more.
Yeah, I still think that more than, I would say 75% of my new clients come from referrals from other attorneys, whether it's someone who goes into one of the larger firms in this area for a domestic case and they don't think they can afford the hourly rate or the retainer that's being required. And so then, you know, I have a number of attorneys who I'm familiar with who will then say, well, look, you know, if you don't think you can afford this, you know, Evan's a good attorney as well, and he might have more reasonable rates for you and might have be able to work out a payment plan or something. I mean, you know, I certainly have that flexibility.
And are you doing anything to cultivate those referral relationships with other attorneys?
I go to lunch a lot. Lunch and golf and things like that. And it's funny because, you know, I'll go a couple weeks without really making any efforts whatsoever. And then I'll just happen to see someone at the courthouse, or I'll happen to see someone anywhere. And then, you know, the next day I get a call from someone saying so-and-so recommended you. And it really just, every time I do it, it reinforces to me that I don't do enough of just trying to put my face in front of other lawyers and spend time with them, so that when something comes in, you know, in that 30 seconds where they have to think about who to send a case to, my name will be fresh in their mind. So I try to do it on a one-on-one basis, you know, lunches, phone calls, things like that. But then also I've tried to be more active in the Bar Association over the past year or so, because that's certainly a good way to do it as well.
Well, that's a great segue, Evan, because I wanted to also spend a few minutes talking about your association with the bar here in Montgomery County. Evan is the co-chair of the solo and small firm section of the Bar Association of Montgomery County. And tell us a little bit about how that came about, Evan.
Well, the section itself actually existed before. So this new run of it isn't really the creation of the section, but it's the revival of the section. I don't know when it fizzled out, but I do know that I find the state solo bar association to be a very valuable resource. The listserv is great for asking questions to other attorneys. I've gotten a number of referrals from it, some really excellent referrals, cases that turned out to be great cases for me. And I've met some good people on it. And I was surprised in the very beginning that the county bar did not have a similar section. And so I think that last year at the strategic planning meeting, which I wasn't a part of, but I know some other people who were, they finally decided, well, we need to revive this section. And then we had, I think just through people who they knew, different lawyers they knew, we had a meeting of about maybe 10 solo lawyers. And I, along with David Schiller, offered to be the co-chairs. You know, I feel like I do offer that sort of background of starting the firm right out of law school that's helpful to some people who are doing the same. And so I wanted to be involved in that way. And so we have now revived the section. Our first meeting was very successful. We had, I think, 35 to 40 people there. And so I guess our first meeting was back in March. And then we're going to have another meeting actually tomorrow night, where we are going to have a speaker who offers a paralegal service. A lot of, I think, solo practitioners would like help from time to time, but they don't necessarily want to bring on the overhead of hiring a full-time paralegal, either because of the cost or because they just don't have that amount of work. And so we're going to have someone come in who's going to talk to us about sort of contract paralegal services, as well as some tech ideas that she's aware of, working with several different law firms. And that's exactly what we want to do with this section. We want to offer resources to solo practitioners that might be something that's commonplace in larger firms, but as someone who is by themselves or maybe with one other lawyer, they just don't have that infrastructure. And we want to help people build sort of shared infrastructure resources so that we all have access to the things that we need without necessarily being hamstrung by, if you're looking at paying for admin help or research or something, if you have one lawyer bringing in fees, it's a lot harder than if you have 30 lawyers bringing in fees to justify those costs. So we're trying to find ways to provide resources that will help people with those types of resources.
Well, interestingly, you mentioned the Maryland State Bar Association solo section. Of course, it's led by the ever popular Pat Yevics, who was our guest on episode 8 here of The Law Entrepreneur, and Valerie Nowotnik, who's your guest for tomorrow night's local solo meeting. She was our guest here on episode 9 of The Law Entrepreneur. So great minds think alike, Evan. I think you'll find that Valerie's going to add a lot of value to the folks in the section and should be make for a really wonderful evening. So, Evan, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to be with me today. There's a whole bunch of other stuff I'd love to chat with you about going forward. I'd like to kind of build on the success that you have shown here. I mean, clearly, for you, creating a solid reputation amongst other attorneys and within the courthouse has paid tremendous dividends, and you couple that with your networking with those attorneys to keep top of mind, and you have a referral system. It's there, and it's clearly working for you. And I kind of want to explore that a little further with you at some point. Can I invite you to come back on the show again at a later date?
Absolutely. I look forward to doing that. I appreciate you asking me to be involved in this, Neil.
Well, it's great to have you here, and tell our audience how they can reach out and contact you if they want to follow up on anything that you mentioned.
Sure. I can. My office is here at 4550 Montgomery Avenue. I'm on the 7th floor, and I have a website, www.goiteenlaw.com. That's G-O-I-T-E-I-N law.com. And then, but anybody can call me, 301-323-8272. I try to be very responsive in terms of returning phone calls and emails. I think that's important.
How about a quick email address?
Evan, E-V-A-N, at goiteenlaw.com.
Perfect. All right, Evan. Well, thanks ever so much for being a guest here on The Law Entrepreneur, and we'll see you around the courthouse.
Thanks, Neil. Appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for listening and being a part of today's program. The utmost compliment you could pay me is to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and leave a strong 5-star review if you think the podcast and what we're trying to do here is worthwhile. Feel free to share the link to the podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers. I would be very appreciative if you did. So until next time, thanks again for listening to The Law Entrepreneur.